This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, the 10th anniversary of 9/11. We'll focus on how this event has impacted Europe over the past decade.
I think that there was an overreaction on our parts and perhaps on the parts of the Americans to some of the threats that we faced. And I think we saw some laws, some powers enacted which did go too far.
We'll look at how the attacks on the Twin Towers divided NATO and European allies. Why Turks are still clinging to conspiracy theories. How Russia exploited 9/11 on the home front, and how that day changed Austria's art scene. Those stories and more coming up in the programme.
This just in, you are looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center. CNN Center right now is just beginning to work on this story, obviously calling our sources and trying to figure out exactly what happened, but clearly something relatively devastating happening this morning there on the south end of the island of Manhattan. That is, once again, a picture of one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
This week marks the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and we're looking at how this momentous event has impacted politics and society here in Europe over the past decade. And we turn first to the UK, Washington's closest ally. Just hours after the 9/11 attacks, the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, made it clear he would stand firmly with President George W. Bush. It meant going to war in Afghanistan. But just over a year later, it also meant invading Saddam Hussein's Iraq on what many saw as very flimsy evidence. In the 10 years since then, the UK's standing in the world has changed, and so too has British society. Lars Bavanger's report from the UK starts with Tony Blair's reaction on 9/11.
This mass terrorism is the new evil in our world today. It is perpetrated by fanatics who are utterly indifferent to the sanctity of human life. And we, the democracies of this world, are going to have to come together to fight it together and eradicate this evil completely from our world.
Then Prime Minister Tony Blair, just over an hour after the first plane hit, already signalling what's to come. The UK would stand shoulder to shoulder with the US in what President George W. Bush, a few days later, called the War on Terror. The long-established so-called special relationship between the two nations was about to be cemented further with a joint war. Less than 1 month on from 9/11, UK warships and planes launched Operation Enduring Freedom alongside US forces to topple the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. Mr. Blair would face criticism from those arguing this was an illegal war, but that was nothing against the popular outcry over what was to come.
America has no truer friend than Great Britain.
In January 2003, Tony Blair met President Bush at the White House. They discussed a possible invasion of Iraq, and Blair's unquestioning support for the plan was later revealed by British Channel 4 News.
Channel 4 News has seen a secret memo which details that discussion between the two leaders. The President makes it clear there'll be war on Saddam regardless of whether the UN passes a further resolution. The Prime Minister replies he is, quotes, solidly with the President.
The biggest political demonstration in 2,000 years of British history.
On the eve of the invasion of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets of London and other UK cities in protest against the impending war. There was not sufficient proof that Saddam Hussein had any weapons of mass destruction, and even less evidence linked his regime in any way to the 9/11 attacks. The government and other politicians supporting the war became deeply unpopular with many voters, and the Iraq invasion tarnished the UK's image with many on the international stage. But the UK was changing at home as well.
I don't know why I was stopped. I feel at that time treated like a second-class citizen for the first time in my life, and I never thought that would ever happen.
Tougher anti-terror legislation began restricting people's freedoms, and more often than not, it was Muslims bearing the brunt. This is Ashif Ahmed from Scotland. He's part of a statistic showing Asians are 42 times more likely to be held under anti-terror laws compared to white people. Mr. Ahmed was stopped by security officials after getting off a domestic flight.
They asked me, are you willing to work with us, keep an eye on the Muslim, Edinburgh Muslim community, inform if there's anything wrong or dodgy, you know, any form of extremism or terrorism legislation should be intelligence-led, not ethnically-led. And that's what's been happening for the last 10 years.
The post-9/11 anti-terror legislation is currently undergoing a review, overseen by Lord MacDonald, a former director of public prosecutions.
I think that there was an overreaction on our parts and perhaps on the parts of the Americans to some of the threats that we faced. And I think we saw some laws, some powers enacted which did go too far.
UK forces have left Iraq and should be pulling out of Afghanistan in 2015. The UK-US relationship seems as special as ever, but there's a very different administration in Washington now. Few here believe the current centre-right coalition government will face the same choice as Tony Blair did 10 years ago, to back the US in a war not sanctioned by the UN. Lars Bevanger, Deutsche Welle Radio, Manchester.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, Germany and France pledged their support for Washington. Both countries sent troops to Afghanistan. But unlike Britain, Berlin and Paris were strongly opposed to the invasion of Iraq, leading to a chill in transatlantic ties. In the following two reports, we'll look at the impact of 9/11 on French and German foreign policy. And we begin with Ben Knight in Berlin.
For many Germans, there was a special reason to express solidarity with the United States in the shell-shocked aftermath of September 11. The atmosphere was especially emotional in Berlin, where many people recalled how America had protected the western half of the city during the Cold War. Germany was also one country that had first-hand experience of what a compassionate military occupier the US could be. If there was ever a country that would be able to see America as a benevolent power, crushing a cruel dictator, helping a brutalized population back to its feet and actively nurturing democracy, it should be Germany. But within a year of the Al-Qaeda attacks on New York and Washington, that half-century of goodwill and gratitude had turned to barely disguised rancour between Chancellor Gerhard Schröder and President George Bush. The sticking point, of course, was Germany's opposition to the Iraq War. Perhaps the iconic moment came at the NATO Security Conference in Munich in 2003, when German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer told those assembled, including Defence Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, what he thought of the WMD intelligence in Iraq.
You have to make the case. And to make a case in the democracy, you must convince by yourself. And excuse me, I'm not convinced. This is my problem. And I cannot go to the public and say, oh, well, let's go to war because there are reasons and so on, and I don't believe in that.
And time has not exactly healed the rift. Schröder and Bush have exchanged quite nasty barbs in their memoirs. While Schröder scoffed at what he called Bush's biblical semantics, Bush accused Schröder of changing his position on Iraq when his re-election hung on the question in 2002. Both men have a point. Schröder's hardening anti-US stance proved decisive in extending his chancellorship until 2005. Relations then improved a lot under Angela Merkel, who quickly developed an unlikely personal rapport with Bush. But oddly, as if to mirror Schröder's anti-war stance, this year Merkel once again led Germany on a contrary course to her major allies by abstaining on the UN vote over military action in Libya. It would seem, then, that Germany has a pacifist instinct when it comes to conflict abroad. But there is another story behind this. Beneath the non-violent veneer, German intelligence agencies have worked very closely with their US counterparts in tracking down Al-Qaeda. particularly after it became clear that many of those involved in the 9/11 attacks had lived in Germany. Ben Knight, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. France's relations with the U.S. have seen quite a roller coaster ride since the 9/11 attacks. In the immediate aftermath, France was right behind its transatlantic ally. French President Jacques Chirac was the first foreign leader to visit President George Bush, and French newspaper Le Monde summed up the country's unprecedented empathy and support for America with its September 12th headline, "We are all Americans." The 9/11 attacks had a huge influence on French domestic and foreign policy. France stepped up security at home and followed the U.S. to war against al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, where it remains a decade later. But more importantly, says Philippe Moreau de Farge with the French Institute for International Relations, 9/11 made the French realize that they, too, were vulnerable.
9/11 make the French aware that they were a Western country, and they were deeply linked to the United States. And there's a feeling that terrorism was a threat concerning not only the United States, but all the Western world.
However, this link was sorely tested a few years later when the U.S. took aim at the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. France was vehemently opposed to the U.S. military invasion and led world opposition to what it considered Washington's war.
La France d'un vieux continent comme le mien, l'Europe.
Dominique de Villepin, who was French foreign minister at the time, gave a fiery speech at the United Nations in New York, a rallying cry against what France considered an illegal attack on Iraq without the agreement of the United Nations. But de Villepin's speech failed to impress the Bush administration. The war was launched by the Coalition of the Willing. Old Europe made way for New Europe, and French fries were renamed Freedom Fries. Today, transatlantic ties have all but been restored, and France itself is spearheading NATO's military operations against the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi.
And that was Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. As a result of 9/11, Russia and the US put their differences aside to work together in the fight against terrorism. There are varying views on whether the past decade has made much of an impact on terrorist activities, even with Osama bin Laden now gone. In Russia, the threats still remain. Karen Percy reports from Moscow.
When the Twin Towers came down in New York on that fateful day in September, the shockwaves were felt even in Russia. Then President Vladimir Putin was the first world leader to call his US counterpart to express his condolences. Putin talked of terrorism as the world's common foe, linking it with the Chechen insurgency within Russia's borders. Some commentators now say Putin used 9/11 to justify harsh action in local trouble spots, all in the name of the global war on terrorism. There have been many reports of illegal detentions, torture and deaths in Russia's troubled North Caucasus and other regions. But that has failed to curtail the rise of homegrown terrorism over the past decade, which have claimed hundreds of lives. There was the 2002 storming of a Moscow theatre by Chechen rebels, who took 900 people hostage for 3 days. In 2004, a similar scene played out at a school in the Caucasus town of Beslan. Last year in March, there were coordinated suicide bombings inside Moscow's metro system during the morning rush hour. And earlier this year, a deadly bomb attack targeted Moscow's busiest airport. Russians now are as concerned as ever.
No, I don't think the world is a safer place now. If it was common in the Middle East before, terrorism and all that, now it's all over the world.
It started earlier in the U.S., all those big terrorist acts, but Russia has failed to draw any lessons from this.
While Russia has claimed to be a partner in the global anti-terrorism campaign, it has alienated the West by refusing to join the military efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. and it has continued to back Iran, despite Tehran's support for terrorist groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. Russia has also grown more critical of the West and its military operations, and so there's been a rise in anti-American sentiment. Even some younger Russians remain sceptical about the events of 9/11.
I think it was action made by American government. It is not Asian terrorist. I think it was Americans. American military men.
This is a common refrain in Russia, where outlandish conspiracy theories are given credence at the highest level. Russia's inconsistency stems partly from the lack of trust that is ingrained in the Russian psyche, which goes back to before even the Soviet times. But it also reflects Vladimir Putin's desire to restore Russia's status as a nation of great influence, one that can balance the United States and other Western allies. Karen Pusey, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
Well, conspiracy theories about 9/11 are also prevalent in Turkey, one of Washington's NATO allies. According to a recent poll, many Turks are sceptical as to whether Muslim terrorists were indeed responsible for the attacks in the US. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
Taksim Square, with its shops and bars, is the heart of Istanbul. If you ask shoppers who was responsible for 9/11... you get surprising answers. Take this man, for instance.
It was America. They did it to themselves. They just wanted an excuse to invade Iraq and to extend their power around the globe. It's all about oil. I'm sorry if you find this shocking, but it's the truth.
Such a controversial view is far from unusual. In fact, according to a recent survey carried out in 13 Muslim countries, only 30% of Turks believe Muslims carried out the 9/11 attacks. Turkey's a country of conspiracy theories. Add to that a large dose of anti-Americanism, the fresh memories of the Iraq War, and the results are not surprising, according to political scientist Cengiz Aktar. Although he says the 9/11 conspiracy theory is just as much a conspiracy against Muslims.
In 1968, when American astronauts went to the moon and there was also a poll taken in Turkey, people didn't believe that they went there. So it's probably same type of incredulity. When 9/11 happened, there are many in the world, not only Muslims, thought that it was something which was organized by the Americans themselves. So minimizing thereby the capabilities of the Muslims to conduct such a high-scale terror action, which needs high skills and technology.
While the majority of Turks do not believe Muslim terrorists were responsible for the 9/11 attacks, the country has no problem arresting its own people for terror offences. According to a worldwide survey, of the 105,000 people detained for terror-related crimes since 9/11, a third of them occurred in Turkey. While hundreds of them were in connection with Al-Qaeda, the vast majority were linked to the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
And I'm Helen Senian-Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Like all great tragedies, 9/11 has inspired art. For the artist, it can be a form of individual therapy. And for the observer, it can give perspective to something still incomprehensible. In Vienna, for the 10th anniversary of 9/11, well-known local and international artists have been asked to respond to the question, how did you experience the 11th of September? Kerry Skyring reports.
Music by German composer Karl-Heinz Stockhausen. A great artist, but not the most politically astute. Shortly after 9/11, he described the attacks as the biggest work of art there has ever been. he was speaking in abstract about the devil's work of art. Inevitably, he was misquoted in the media, and in the ensuing scandal, his concerts were cancelled. When artists grapple with great events, controversy is part of the picture. Austrian artist Karl Killian was in Berlin when the 9/11 attacks took place.
I was working in Berlin in a synagogue, and on the next day we had a big tank in front of the synagogue because everybody thought the Third World War is coming now. After that, really, it was winter. The winter started this year, not somewhere in October or November, really 9/11. Nobody was going out. The streets were empty in the night. It was cold from one moment to the other.
Deeply shocked by the loss of life, at first, Karl did not know how to react.
3,000 to 4,000 people die, you have a problem. Because you cannot imagine this. You can only see an abstraction.
But as an artist, he did react to the political reaction to 9/11. Offended by the restrictions on personal and public freedom launched in the United States and parts of Europe in the wake of the attacks, he created an installation called My Own Private WTC. He uses photography, projections, paintings, and a short film.
There are many movies where you have this World Trade Center, of course, and how they use it, and different angles. We started to search the movies for these scenes, and we cut this together, and this is called My Own Private World Trade Center. And this is the core of the exhibition here.
The works of 25 artists are shown in the exhibition known as 9/11 We Remember. They're from Europe and the United States, and the works are as varied as the media they use. Everything from sketches to kinetic sculptures. The curator is Ursula Pfeiffer.
The experience of this day of September 11 was my first intention to show that the individual memory, the personal memory of this event, not so far the political sense, but the individual story.
Some of the works were created in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Like Pablo Picasso's Guernica, painted in anger and sorrow after the destruction of the Basque city by bombers during the Spanish Civil War, they tend to reflect the shock and the dimensions of the human tragedy. But in the later works, Ursula notes a trend.
The concern of the event is more critical as time went on. I think there is some political sense because there was the Iraq war and war against terrorism, and there were many, many events that led to a critical position.
Austrian painter and writer Sonja Hennisch is interested in the conspiracy theories which have swirled around the events of 9/11. In her painting, To Make the Dust, a woman flees from the ash cloud, and in the background there are faceless figures with Ku Klux Klan hoods. In another work, The Unholy Trinity, Sonja depicts George W. Bush, Saddam Hussein, and Osama bin Laden, suggesting they are all complicit in the tragedy.
Yes, they dominate the screen out of which the towers fall and crash down. Two children look towards the screen, and a third child, a girl, holds her hands in front of her face and gazes with large eyes towards the observer. And I would like this look to touch as many observers as possible, to make them think.
The Kronos Quartet and their artistic reaction to the events of 10 years ago. Steve Reich's composition, WTC 9/11, has been called electrifying and haunting. Like the exhibition, 9/11 We Remember, it reminds us how 9/11 haunts us still. Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
And if you'd like to send us your thoughts and memories of 9/11, do get in touch. Our email address is europe@dw-world.de. That's europe@dw-world.de. Or write to us at Inside Europe, the English service, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. Looking forward to hearing from you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Over the next half hour, can creativity kickstart the economy in eastern Germany? The Dutch dream of a homegrown mountain. A pioneering scheme to enable the blind to go hiking in France. And Romania's shepherds keep a close eye on their traditions. Those stories and more coming up. Britain is facing a massive housing crisis. According to the homeless charity, Shelter, more than 1.7 million people are on waiting lists for social housing. Successive British governments, who have been keen to keep private house prices climbing, have failed to build enough new affordable homes. But one research group has come up with an idea to pay for new social housing. Nick Martin reports from London.
Lately, experts have been asking who has the right to live in the centre of an expensive city like London. As the price of property here has skyrocketed over the years, social housing tenants have found themselves living in locations that most reasonably high income earners can only dream of. A public tenant pays a rent of around £100 a week for a one-bedroom flat, while private rents can be anywhere from £200 to £500 a week. The cost of buying even the smallest home in central London is at least £500,000. And that's led one research group to question whether it's feasible for many of society's poorest people to continue living in the centre of the city.
We have some preliminary data that indicates that people across all three parties, even a majority of Labour voters, agree with the idea that you shouldn't have sort of expensive social housing.
Alex Morton from the Policy Exchange, who authored a report called Making Housing Affordable.
You know, there's a middle ground where you say, well, you know, let's try and make it decent and so you end up with the horrendous concrete ghettos. But on the other hand, you don't want to have sort of Chelsea townhouses, which, you know, in some cases, there are cases where there are million-pound council properties, which is just a bizarre situation to be in.
The group says that Britain's most expensive social housing, like those homes in the fashionable borough of Islington, should be sold off, and the funds used to build several properties in cheaper parts of London.
So Islington has 4,500 street properties. Some of those sort of three-bedroom, four-bedroom flats may be worth more than £1 million. The ones that are houses are almost certainly worth more than £1 million. And when you consider that's just one in London Council with 4,500 very valuable properties, you sort of work it out across the whole of central London. And then you add in there'll be expensive properties dotted throughout the rest of the country. We think you could easily get to a situation where you could probably double or triple the amount of social homes being built just by doing this, by selling off those more expensive properties.
Despite cries from some quarters that the plans would see a mass exodus of low-income workers from central London, the research body says that their plans only apply to the most expensive properties. And what would be the impact of moving social housing tenants to the outskirts of the British capital?
Businesses that we've spoken to, they feel if there wasn't the housing available in central London for people on low incomes, they'd have real problems. They couldn't afford to pay people more. It would affect the economy.
Peabody is London's largest housing association, with more than 19,000 homes, many of them in central areas of the city. Chief Executive Stephen Howlett thinks low-income tenants play a vital role in the London economy and would suffer.
People who work in the shops in central London, in Oxford Street, are on low wages. If they had to move to other areas, they'd spend a lot of money travelling, a lot of time travelling. Sometimes they're working on social hours in restaurants and hotels.
But with many as half of all social housing tenants in some London boroughs on welfare, many think the economy might benefit if more workers could live more centrally. Perhaps middle-class Londoners may have more sympathy if they themselves weren't commuting long distances from the outskirts of the capital, paying some of the highest public transport costs in the world. Stephen Howlett accepts that social housing rents haven't kept pace with market prices.
Sometimes they've been too low, and we need to make sure that the people who live in these homes can pay rent that's fair in relation to what they earn. I think there's a big gap in London as well between the low-cost social housing that we've got, and the market. You've got a lot of people who don't necessarily qualify for the low rent, the low social rented housing, but can't afford the market. And I think what we've got to do is try and meet that need in our city as well.
So housing associations say they can build more affordable homes if they can put up rents. But the Policy Exchange says their idea will bring in much more income, allowing more cheaper homes to be built. After all, if you sell off a property worth £1 million and set a cap on the cost of building a replacement home at the price of an average London house, that's £350,000, you can build three properties for every expensive one you sell. Alex Morton again from the Policy Exchange.
Because the cap would be at the average, it would mean that you would have roughly half of all areas, half of all properties to move into. So it's not sort of saying, oh, let's, you know, shunt everyone to the worst 10 or 20% of districts. It's saying, let's mix in people with people who are working, but on the other hand, let's stop giving people homes that, you know, the average taxpayer who has to commute 45 minutes a day can only dream of. And I think a lot of people see that that's an inherently unfair proposition.
Commentators say even if there's no agreement on how to pay for new affordable homes, the British government still needs to tackle a growing housing crisis. Despite the economic downturn, it's estimated that 200,000 new homes are required in England every year. Last year, just over half that number were finished. Nick Martin, Deutsche Welle, London.
Well, in parts of eastern Germany, the problem is sometimes finding people to fill homes. Some cities and towns there haven't recovered from the economic collapse following reunification. And many people have packed their bags and moved elsewhere to find jobs. An added problem is that Germany's population is shrinking. The birth rate's stalled. Baby boomers are ageing. But in the town of Hoyerswerda, residents hope creativity can kickstart the city's growth. Caitlin Carroll reports.
About 70 people, both young and old, cluster together backstage for a pre-performance pep talk. These amateur dancers then slowly walk onto the stage to begin Hoyerswerda Lives. It's a 45-minute dance and video project choreographed by Dirk Lennig. Lennig is a professional ballet dancer and Hoyerswerda resident. He explains why the stage set is bare, except for some large video screens.
You see the screens here? So you have different video screens, and then you see like people dancing in different parts in Hoyerswerda. They have interviews, they're talking about their relationship to the city and their past, actually, to the history or what they want from the city or what they expect from the city.
Lennig says residents expect a lot, like growth and a good quality of life. What they've had is a boom town that's gone bust. During the height of East Germany's coal industry, this town was home to more than 71,000 people. But the industry died after reunification, forcing about half the population to pack their bags. This economic collapse tumbled some remaining residents into depression and even xenophobia. Many know Hoyerswerda for its race riots in the early 90s, when a group of neo-Nazis attacked asylum seekers. Lennig says the shrinking of the city and its dark past has caused people to turn inside themselves. He hopes art projects like this will introduce residents to their neighbors again and build a sense of shared purpose.
You ask yourself again, okay, my kids are going away or they went away, but how did it affect my life? And so an art project like this is helping you to communicate to yourself, to other people, and to the whole city somehow. And then you reflect a different way, you see it a different way, and this changed a lot.
It's changed life for Torsten Möcklich. He's a recent university graduate and one of the few young people who's decided to stay in the city. Most of his friends left Hoyerswerda because there's no work. He says practicing for 6 months to perform this dance introduced him to new friends and made life a little brighter.
It's a feeling of life we have when we dance, and we have in life a little bit of the feeling from the project.
Lennig says that's why he encouraged the dancers to tell their stories on video and to be part of choreographing the dance.
It's like a strong community, and they really believe in each other and they're supporting each other, and that's all about the city, you know. It's like that's the story of city anyway, a city which is shrinking, and you need to share resources and you need to share emotional journey as well. You know, if you share it, it's easier to handle the things and also to build up something positive out of it.
Lennig's family played a large role in the history of this city. His father helped design some of the large apartment buildings that housed workers in the coal industry back in the 60s. Now Lenig's sister, Dort Baumeister, has followed her father's footsteps into architecture. But instead of building, she's taking a creative approach to deconstruction.
Manche Plätze muss man radikal entscheiden, gibt man der Natur zurück.
Baumeister says a lot of the areas must go back to nature. Along with her brother, she's trying to get residents to think differently about their future and to let go of the past. She says turning Hoyas Verda into a retirement village isn't the answer, nor is waiting for another industry to come along and save the city.
Es kann auch nicht das Ziel sein,
she says that can't be the target. Residents must be more visionary and create an alternative way now, like using old structures for new purposes. They're staging the dance performance in a building that used to be a grocery store. Some buildings in the city have been torn down entirely so the space can make way for gardens and small farms. Christine Hahnemann is an urban sociologist. She's done research on changing cities for more than 15 years. She says transitioning abandoned buildings is the first step. Another city near Hoyas Verda is using empty high-rise estates to house mushroom farms. But Hahnemann cautions that's just a start.
The main problem of shrinking cities is, of course, the losing on jobs, and to give the people a perspective for their life. And in this case, we don't have not a lot of very new ideas.
She says it's not impossible to turn around a city heading towards obsolescence.
There are some people, and you will find them in Hoyas Verda and so on, trying to make something with this bad situation.
Hahnemann calls people like Lenig and Baumeister Raumpioniere, or pioneers of the space. She says post-industrial cities like Hoyas Verda need visionaries to help imagine a new future for the city. Hahnemann believes that if people don't try anything, the prognosis is not good.
Some of the city, they don't find another way, and so I call them the superficial cities. They have no function anymore. Think about the old ghost towns. They face the same process, and today they are a spot for tourists.
Lenig and Baumeister aren't ready to accept that fate. And from the dedication of the dancers, it seems a lot of the community shares their optimism. The event's sold out, and the audience is captivated during one of the last songs.
Zukunft ist eine abgeschossene Kugel.
It's Gundermann. It's a local songwriter from the area. And it's about the future. And he's saying something like, it's your life. You know, it doesn't matter. At the end, you have to decide what you want to do. And you can wait, or you can put something into it. Of course, you live anyway. But you have to decide how you want to live, either like this or like this. And at the end, you have to decide.
And on this evening, many of Hoyas Verda's residents have decided that although their city is shrinking, their hope for the future doesn't have to. Caitlin Carroll, Deutsche Welle Radio, Hoyas Verda.
For Radio on the Road, download the latest in news and current affairs from Deutsche Welle's European Weekly Inside Europe. Go to dwworld.de/inside-europe and click on Download. Or subscribe the show. Click on the podcast button on DW World's front page. That's dwworld.de for the latest podcasts. Don't leave home without one.
It started as a joke, but it could result in the Dutch joining the Alpine Club. Now, if you've been to the Netherlands, you'll know it's as flat as a pancake, but that could change. Sports journalist Thijs Zonneveld recently suggested in a tongue-in-cheek article that an artificial mountain should be built in the country. And the idea seems to have captured the imagination of the Dutch. An architects firm has drawn up plans for a 2,000-metre peak, and all sorts of sporting clubs, corporations and local authorities are getting involved with the idea. But why does Thijs Zonneveld think that the Netherlands needs a mountain? I put that question to him.
Actually, it's very simple. We, as Dutch people, we go on holiday to the mountains
in summertime and in wintertime to hike or to bike or to have a picnic with a view or to ski. And we do that practically every time we take a holiday. And I just took the other way around. What if we can take the mountains to us instead of going to the mountains ourselves?
And I believe this idea has suddenly become very popular in your country.
Yeah, and that shows that Dutch people, they're attracted by mountains and they are attracted by the idea of having one. And I think that's what's made this project in a very quick time so big, and there's so much positive energy behind it, and that's all because of that, I think.
Now, I believe an architect's firm has now drawn up plans for this man-made mountain. The bad news is that it could be rather expensive. I've read estimates that it might cost 300 billion euros. So is the plan really serious?
I want to react on that number because that's, well, to be honest, that's sheer nonsense. I don't know who came up with those numbers. We are going to need at least 6 months to calculate what it's going to cost. We don't even know yet how to construct it because there are several ways to do that. So there are professionals who are going to need months and months to calculate that. I don't know who came up with the other numbers, but to be honest, that's just nonsense.
But who else is supporting the idea then?
Practically, we have expertise of all the terrains we need. So you can think of engineering agencies, of architects, of financial economic guys, of marketeers. Everything that should be in it is in it already, and we're talking about big companies. To give you an example of the biggest 10 engineering companies of Holland, 6 are already talking and engineering and drawing and calculating about this. Well, it started off really big, and it's going to get bigger day by day.
So what could this mountain look like, and what are you going to do with it?
At first, the most attracting factor about it is sports and recreation. So we're talking about cycling, about skiing, about rafting, hiking, bobsleighing, having roller coasters on it. That's one of the biggest things about it. And if we can make this a hollow structure, that's what some architects are drawing right now, then you can put a lot of things in it as well. And then you can think about the shopping malls and parking decks, but also about water power plants and food change. The possibilities are sheer endless, but that provides us with a lot of opportunities to earn back the money that we put in it.
You mentioned skiing there. Is that really a possibility? I mean, it's going to have to be a pretty high mountain, isn't it?
If you're talking about height, then you're just thinking about natural snow. And we already spoke with a lot of snow makers. And then we're talking about artificial snow. And there's not really a big difference between those two. What you could make any time of the year, you could have slopes with snow, even on sea level.
Now, of course, the Dutch have shown great talent over the years at reconstructing the landscape. You've reclaimed land from the sea. You've created a huge artificial lake. You've built dikes to protect low-lying areas. A mountain, though, is pretty extreme. Aren't you worried that it's going to scar that beautiful, classic Dutch landscape?
Yeah, but we've got so much of that flat landscape, and of course there's going to be people who are going to say, we don't like this, we don't like the view of having a mountain in our country, but we're just going to have to see how many those people will be. We're just going to see about that, but it's not like we're changing the whole of Holland. We'll just change one region. We'll give one region or one community one mountain. We're not going to change the whole of the Netherlands in one big mountain.
And that was Dutch journalist Thijs Zonneveld. Well, France has lots of real mountains, and they're popular with holidaymakers at this time of year. Many head to the Alps or the Pyrenees to take in the spectacular scenery and enjoy the fresh air. Hiking paths are well marked with patches of red and white paint. But now France is opening up hiking to the blind with a pioneering scheme in the Southern Alps. John Laurenson has been finding out more.
The pedantic hiking party leader in the hit French comedy The Hikers explains how to walk. It's not surprising the film was a hit, though the French have been called a lot of things in their time. A nation of hikers is not one you usually hear. And yet 30 million French people, that's half the population, practice the sport regularly. And now there's no excuse for the blind to join them, because in the Mercantour National Park in the Southern Alps, they've set up the first ever guided hike for the non-sighted.
Sur ce casque, tu as un GPS.
A mountain guide explained this new bit of technology to a non-seeing hiker. On his headset, he says, you've got a GPS and a 3D compass, which enables the headset to know which way you're facing.
L'orientation de ta tête.
The headset guides you along the trail, telling you which way to go and warning you of obstacles. But it also works a bit like a museum audio guide.
On appelle ce mélèze les trois arbres. Faites-en le tour et comptez les...
Touch the bark, says the guide, and smell the resin. The guide also tells you how to recognise a particular tree, a badger's hole, or about the history of a stone hut on the side of the path. Michel Drouet has been totally blind for 8 years. He's a seasoned hiker, but always hikes with a sighted friend. But even accompanied, he can appreciate one advantage for him. It means that I can tell my friend Philippe one or two things, he told TF1 television. It makes you feel less passive. I can give information to him that he doesn't have. The headset, though, is not worn over the ears, but just above them, leaving your flappers free to hear the birds, the wind in the trees, and the distant yelp of a groundhog. Marilyn Alix, who's been blind since birth, has come to the Mercantour to check out the trail and its new technology for the association she works for, and she believes it's a breakthrough.
On a un chemin très facile, pas beaucoup d'obstacles.
It's an easy path, not many obstacles, she said. You can just do it on your own if you guide yourself a bit as well with the noises you hear along the way. There's a lot of talk about access for blind people in the street, in towns, but there's a whole other question, which is access to nature. The trail is 2 kilometres long, not much for a hardened hill walker like Michel Drouet, but for many other blind people, the experience in the Mercantour Valley will be a completely new one and a good first stage. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Across Europe, people are trying to embrace a greener, more sustainable way of life. For many Romanians, though, that kind of lifestyle has always been the norm. Around 40% of the population there lives in rural areas. One example of a traditional existence that's remained unchanged over the centuries is shepherding. Tom Wilson has been finding out more about this way of life.
I'm 2,000 metres up in the Buchej Mountains. For 6 months of the year, this mountain plateau is home to 12 shepherds. As well as the 1,000 sheep, there are 134 cows to milk, pigs to look after, and dogs to guard all these animals from wolves and bears. Nelu, the head of the shepherds, is 45. He's bustling in and out of the stunner, the low wooden shed where the shepherds eat and sleep. He's wearing a traditional bell-shaped Romanian hat, a clop perched on his head and a tattered waistcoat. He tells me what a typical shepherd's day looks like.
The sun comes up at 6, 6.30, but by 4 we're already up, milking. Once we've finished milking, then we eat. Then we take the animals out to graze. Some people make cheese, others look after the animals, and everyone returns at 4 o'clock.
Then, all through the evening, there's more work to be done. The animals need milking again, and there's a lot more cheese to be made. Bebe, one of the shepherds, explains how they manage to milk so many animals.
Each person has cows that they milk. I don't milk his cows, and he doesn't milk mine.
Bebe insists that I have a go myself.
This is working quite well.
Or so I think, until I watch how the professionals do it. You can just hear the difference there between my rather pathetic milking effort and Bebe's. Then the milk is taken down to the sheepfold where it's boiled.
this is the sound of me pouring 20 litres of milk through the muslin and into the cauldron below.
The milk is left to stand, homemade rennet added, and then the milk is gently heated. It's an especially tough life. The diet is pretty limited, with most meals consisting of cheese and slices of polenta, and maybe a little soup. Up here in the mountains, they also have to face attacks on the sheep by bears and wolves. And being away for 6 months each year, it also seems to take its toll on family life.
I have three children. My wife ran off. She went to the devil. They've grown up. The oldest is 17. They come to see me. Our boss brings them up in his car. They come and stay with me at home. My ex-mother-in-law looks after them now. I have to pay the maintenance every month.
I ask Nelu how people manage to cope with such a tough existence.
It depends on your constitution. Some people can take it, others can't.
I find Toma sat on a traditional one-legged stool, milking. He wears brown overalls secured with a string belt. I ask him if he doesn't sometimes get sick of it all.
What can we do, though? Die? It's a tough profession, very tough. It's always raining. You get wet and cold. But that's what the job's like.
It turns out that many of them are actually related.
We're like family. The boy who just left with the sheep, he's my cousin. We're five cousins here.
Toma is 58. He's one of the oldest men here and has never known a different way of life.
From father to son, we've had this profession, looking after animals. I was 6 years old when my father took me with him to look after the cows. I can still remember it today.
Gheorghe has a similar story.
I've done this ever since I was 12. My parents had lots of children, and there were no jobs for us and not much money, so we had to. But I like it. It's something I've liked ever since I was young.
I ask Nicu if things didn't change when the communists took power in Romania after the Second World War.
There was never collectivisation here. OK, we weren't allowed to slaughter calves. We had to give them to the state. But how it is now, that's how it's always been here.
Unlike most farms in the West, here in the sheepfold, everything is 100% organic. They don't use antibiotics and instead use herbal and natural remedies. It's undoubtedly a tough existence, but it's a stark contrast to the mechanised, chemical-intensive farming methods that you find in the developed world. You can't help thinking that perhaps we might have something to learn from these time-honoured methods. Tom Wilson, Deutsche Welle, Romania.
And that report brings us to the end of this week's show. Hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget to contact us if you have a comment or query. Our email address is europe@dw-world.de. That's europe@dw-world.de. Or you can write to us the old-fashioned way. Our address is Inside Europe, the English Service, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. We're looking forward to hearing from you, and we'll be back at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me, Helen Sini, my colleague Neil King, and sound engineer Levi Rechtenwald. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn. Thank you. You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.